to This Business of Music and Poetry podcast, where the life of a creative meets the real world. I'm Michael Amade, host World Poetry Open Mic, the Michael Amade Show, author of more books than I should mention, poet, musician, and above all, creative entrepreneur. My collaborator and conspirator on this project is Clifford Brooks, founder of the Southern Collective Experience, host of Dante's Old South on NPR, poet, the author of The Draw of Broken Eyes and Whirling Metaphysics, Exiles of Eden, and Athena Departs, A Gospel of a Man Apart. Our guest today is author Robert Gwaltney. His short story, The Deep Down, was recently published in the Signal Mountain Review. He's the recipient of the Atlanta Writers Club Award for Flash Fiction, and he was selected as a top 10 finalist for publication by First Page, an international literary magazine. He just completed writing his first novel, The Cacadia Tree, and an excerpt from this novel will be published in October 2019, the edition on the Blue Mountain Review, and the December 2019 issue of the Dead Mule School of Southern Literature. Alongside his writing, Robert also serves as vice president with the Easter Seals North Georgia Children's Services Incorporated, a nonprofit supporting children and families during the most critical time in a child's development. Without any further ado, here's our interview with Robert Gwaltney.
Well, first of all, Robert, it is fantastic to have you on the show, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm very appreciative of you guys having me on this evening.
This will be fun, I promise, because Amade, well, he's Amade. So, Robert, start at the beginning, man. Give us your background, some of the high notes of your younger years.
Okay. Well, so I was actually, well, I've lived the majority of my life, all but maybe two years in the South. I actually was born overseas in Harlem, Holland, in the Netherlands. My dad was in the service. And he was stationed in Germany. My mom didn't live on the base because they didn't have enough room. So I'm the first of four boys. And so my mom, in her early 20s, off in a foreign country from Cairo, Georgia, where she didn't speak the language, was living in Germany. She had me in a Dutch hospital where she couldn't speak Dutch. And it was back in the day where in America, dads weren't allowed in the delivery room. So he had a very unique experience. But I think about at the age of two, we moved back to my hometown of Cairo, Georgia.
What influences in your childhood? Did any of the European flair come back with your parents at all?
A little bit. You know, I remember being fascinated with a pair of these wooden Dutch shoes that they had, and you know, all of those awful Hummel figurines. So a lot of memorabilia and tchotchkes that my mom and dad brought back. But no, I don't really recall anything from being overseas, but I do recall childhood memories as far back probably as around 3 to 4 years of age.
That's an interesting point. This is kind of random, but let's start with you, Gwaltney. To be an effective storyteller, when you say that you can think back and remember things from 2-3 years old, I hear that often, actually, and I think about it with my friends who are all in the creative circles. Do you think that recollection of detail helps you write the stories that you do?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that memory plays a significant part in shaping who we are and our beliefs, helping mold our frame of reference. So certainly childhood memories do sometimes subconsciously, I think, play into my work, you know, after the fact, when I go back and I try to reason through why the story unfolded as it did. And, you know, the subconscious and memory really is a very interesting, fascinating thing.
When you look at your book, The Cicada Tree, which I have been blessed enough to see some of, in The Cicada Tree, how much of that is autobiographical in that maybe the things said or the imagery created is from your youth or early years?
So I believe that, that there's really no such thing as fiction. You know, I think that it's all sort of nonfiction that's housed in, that's veiled in some way, whether you intend for it to be or not. When I wrote this, I'm at the very end of finalizing and polishing the manuscript. But, you know, I had an opportunity to talk about the work with you and on a previous show. And in preparing for these conversations, really kind of digging into the manuscript, I am surprised at how it is in some way autobiographical, though you would never know it on the surface level. There are themes, I think, that that surfaced that I wasn't quite aware of. You know, I tell the story from the point of view of an 11-year-old girl. Her name is Annalise Newell. And I think that probably in some odd way, I think all the characters in the story are representative of me in some way, but I do relate to Annalise Newell and some of the, she's a bit of an outsider. I think she personally feels as if she's on the fringe, that she might be marginalized in some way because of her family's circumstance. So I do think that, And there's an element of alcoholism. You know, my grandfather, my mom's father, was an alcoholic. So I didn't realize the weight of having experienced that firsthand, and then of course the impact that I had upon my mom. You know, I didn't intentionally set out to put that into the story, but it found its way in there.
So what I'm hearing you saying is that in unexpected ways, writing this story has kind of been a catharsis for you emotionally.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that writing, you know, I feel that I was probably born with a creative, sensitive spirit and the need and want to tell stories in some way. And from a very young age, I wasn't certain what mode that would be. You know, I couldn't sing, couldn't dance, couldn't paint. So, but I did always have an ability to be able to tell stories the traditional way. So I think I just got off track there with what you were asking me. But, I've always wanted to write. My history certainly does. My circumstance, my frame of reference certainly surfaces and finds its way into my writing.
Now, a small caveat here. Gwaltney, you can go off on as many tangents as you want because I am Lord Tangent, and we won't get through the show. Yeah. I am Grand Poombah of the figure eight. So
it's so refreshing, Robert. It's so refreshing to be in a room where I am not the guy who goes off on the most tangents. You have to understand, it is so rare for me to be in that room. This is so good. So you're absolutely. This is what this platform is made for: is tangential thought. However, if I might, Cliff, I am hearing you speak. I really. Really kind of connects with me as I found writing fiction, writing poetry in a way. It's in it. My parts of my life creep in scenarios, things that, like you said, no one might not ever recognize in the writing. However, it feels like in a way writing fiction is kind of this vague way of making sense of these events in a different light, in a different way. And I've definitely felt that. Do you feel like because of the cathartic experience of writing some of this stuff, do you feel like anything is resolving in a different way? Or do you feel like it was more you leaning into the experiential nature of being able to explore them in a fictional context?
So the whole process of writing for me is an emotional experience. And if I have a really good day of reading, a really good day of writing, and I go back and I'm reading it, or I share it with my significant other, I find myself being moved emotionally by first having created something, being proud of it. And I do think sometimes the resolution of being able to have found the words to express an emotion or a point of view, definitely.
I can feel that for sure.
Now, Gwaltney, we've had author Roger Johns on here before, and he talked with us about how he went through an extensive process and how to learn to write from women characters with a reality and genuineness that's hard to come by. how do you capture such convincing female characters, especially that of Annalise Newell?
So I think that probably a lot of it has to do with my upbringing. You know, growing up in the South, I was raised up by a tribe of remarkable Southern women, all who could be characters in novels. You know, my mom, my grandmothers, my mom's sisters, and my aunts. And you know, as a little boy, I was a shy child. I gravitated toward women. A lot of my childhood friends and a lot of my adult friends were throughout high school were women, and I connected, I think, on an emotional level there. You know, some of that, I think, probably having to do with the fact that I am a gay American, and so I, being able, I guess, to understand on an emotional level, having the experience, having an intimacy with women, and being able to connect through my own personality, and just having forever and always a listening ear. I don't find it difficult to write from a female perspective, from an emotional sense. There's really nothing special that I even really feel that I have to do to prepare for that. And I can't imagine, oddly enough, and perhaps one day I will, writing a protagonist that is male, if that sounds good.
That's interesting.
Because I just prefer, in my own selections of reading, I much prefer to read a strong female interesting protagonist than I do men sometimes. Not that, you know, I don't find men interesting. Certainly I do.
Right. It's what books lit your fire to, I want to know some of your background from a literary standpoint. Who are the movers and shakers in your literary pantheon that made you want to cleave to writing?
Very diverse. Yeah, and I want to say, I think that, and I'll start back in regards to a book that my grandmother used to read for me, and she would bring my granny Louise. So we went to a small church called Eastside Baptist Church, and I always went to church with her. So she would bribe me to sit up during the service and not fall asleep. So she would always promise me a trip to, it was a, sort of like a Walmart but on a smaller scale, called TGNY, or what she would refer to as the dime store. So we bought this copy of The Velveteen Rabbit, and I became absolutely obsessed with it. So she would read it to me over and over and over again. And so I was fascinated with how lovely and how moving the story was. And of course, what the brilliance of a book like The Velveteen Rabbit is that it resonates with children, but as you grow into adulthood, it has a whole different level of meaning for you. So I, in regards to favorite childhood stories, that would be, I think, a pivotal moment. The first time I ever had that book read to me, and then at the point at which I could actually read it myself. The very first writer I ever met, I was in the third grade in Miss Morton's classroom, and there was a boy who was a year ahead of me. His mom was a local author. Her name is Brenda Graham, and she wrote today probably what you would call cozy fiction with a Christian sensitivity. Mm. But she came into our classroom to tell us about this. I guess it was a bring your parent to school day. And anyway, another classroom shared her with us, and she talked about being a writer. She talked about this novel that she had written titled Stone Gables, and I was absolutely mesmerized. It never occurred to me that writers were living human beings that dwelled amongst us. So that was the first time I thought that it might be possible that you know, I could first of all know a writer and maybe even be a writer. So those were a couple of initial experiences that I had that fascinated me with writing. And of course, there was a novel it was Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, which was gothic in nature, mm-hmm. which absolutely fascinated me. I mean, you have to love a story about an orphan who grows up to go take care of a family that has a crazy wife tied up in the attic.
Right. And again, reading yours, I feel like I'm holding on to a secret because like no one else has seen this. But reading your story, I pick up on the gothic undertones. It's nothing heavy, but you take away the moroseness of it and leave the suspense. You know, that's the way that I feel that it comes through in your text. And what I also read is not only the convincing female characters, but your dialogue is effortless. And I've told you before, and Amadeus and I've talked about this, is that dialogue is the hardest thing to nail down. How do you coax that out of the page?
I think my style, you know, at present, and I perhaps will always be, is lyrical in nature. There's a beat or a rhythm that I strive for and that I toil over. And I think it's the same with dialogue. But I think that for me, one of the things that I don't like in fiction is when you just got this significant block of dialogue, because you know people don't usually speak in soliloquy,
right?
And I think that it has to be convincing. I think that it's so easy to detect with the ear stilted and the eye stilted dialogue, and it right. has to seem natural and it has to seem true to the character. I think what's challenging with dialogue is that you have to have a pacing and a manner of speech for each of your characters. For me, I think, you know, I can't explain, you know, why or how I might be good at dialogue, if in fact I am, but I think I attribute it to the fact that I've always been a bit of an introvert. So I've always, you know, in a busy hustle bustle room, I'm always listening and paying attention to conversation. And I think in life, I'm an active listener. Mm-hmm. So I think that it helps. I've never been one who always has to get a point across. I think that one can learn so much from just listening. And I think that just how I'm wired and environmentally, I'm a good listener. And I think that helps perhaps with being able to write effective dialogue.
That's a common thread that I find with people. Well, I find with those who take this art seriously is that we all seem to keep ourselves humble. I hear often, and I think it's just, you know, it makes you pleasant to be around, and saying like, if I am good at dialogue, you know, if that's, you know, I've heard, you know, well, I try to be the best poet I can, and that humility is refreshing to hear. But what I also hear from you is like, I don't know how to explain how I capture that. Do you find that there's when you're like now pushing to a corner to explain something so ethereal as your creative process, do you find that there's a piece of it that you can't put into words?
Well, absolutely. There are some days, you know, I'll write something and I'll come back to it and I'll think, you know, not so good. And then there are times I'll get like things that I write and I'm like, oh my God, that's pretty darn good. And I don't know that if you asked me to do it again, I could.
Yep.
And I think that sometimes creatively for me, you kind of get into a zone, and and I'm not going to try to turn it into anything metaphysical, but there is sort of this zone, this sort of other plane, this sense that you're utilizing when you're in that place where it comes easily and beautifully. And I can't explain it. It's one of those things that's at times is instinctual. And yeah. of course, the instinct that comes with just trying to write, trying to educate yourself about writing, and reading other writers and listening to them speak about their process. So it's not for me. I believe that there was a natural sensibility that would predispose me to be able to be a good writer. And I would say that I got really serious about it about 15 or so years ago. And I thought, you know what, this is something that I would really want to take seriously. I joined a Atlanta Writers Club. I would go there and listen. I signed up for courses. I took classes at the Margaret Mitchell House. Anytime I had an opportunity to learn and to grow. And really, really the best thing that an individual can do is just sit down at the keypad and write and read.
It's equal parts inspiration and work, right. Hard work. You know, it's, and I want to shift the focus now to what it was like to grow up gay in the South. And the reason that this is really important, because we want now it's obviously a point that understanding is the only thing that's going to make anything better. And I want to bring more of that to the show. And if you're willing, I'd love to hear the perspective of how you grew up and the hardships you faced and how you overcame that.
Sure. Well, you see, as I stated earlier, I was raised, spent up until college, almost my entire life in Cairo, Georgia, which is a lovely place, but it's a small rural community in southwest Georgia. It's in Grady County, and Cairo happens to be the county seat. Me and my mom and dad grew up there. They still reside there, very active in the community, both of them. My parents remain Southern Baptist. I don't consider myself a religious individual. I consider myself now more of a spiritual individual. Mm-hmm. I certainly do abide a lot that I learned growing up in the church. So, with that being said, growing up different in Cairo, Georgia, and probably my experience is not unlike that of other individuals that have grown up. When I grew up, I was a boy of the 70s and an adolescent of the 80s. Mm. And I guess, if you're to tell that story about sexuality, for me, I think I had the sense that at the age of 3, that there was something different. And I remember making note of that in preschool. I went to a private preschool and kindergarten, as most children do in the South, at a Baptist church.
Mm, yeah.
And I remember that the way what I gravitated toward in play in preschool and kindergarten, my eye was always drawn to the creative play area where they have the kitchen. Mm-hmm. So where the girls would go, that's where I wanted to be. I didn't really care much for the trucks. I didn't care much for the blocks. So I knew very early on that I felt different, and I knew that it was noticed by some adults. Mm-hmm. I had a kindergarten teacher. Her name, I won't say her last name, but her first name was Miss Dixie. And there was an assistant teacher in the room with her who was a lovely woman, and I remember her fondly. But I remember, and children know these things, that they have a sense about it. And I knew that I had the sense that she didn't like me for some reason. And I've reasoned out since that I'm sure that it had to do with her concerns about her perceptions of me, what I gravitated toward, how I played. Mm-hmm. And I remember this, my earliest probably very negative, pivotal moment as a child. I remember it was a spring day. It was lovely out, but it was a bit cool. And we were out on the playground. The azaleas were in bloom. The sky was blue. And it's that springtime day where there's this golden hue to the quality of light. I remember that vividly. And we had coats on because it was cool enough outside to still have coats. But it was starting to warm up. And there was this huge, out on the playground, this huge tractor tire that you could sit in and play. And I was there with the girls, and the girls had all picked these lovely azaleas and put them behind their ears. Well, I did the same thing. And so they'd all taken their coats and wrapped them around their waists and like sort of hula skirts. So we were there I was having an awesome time. I had my lovely azalea behind my ear. I had my play pretend hula skirt on. And Miss Dixie, came up behind us and at the time as a boy, and those who still know me call me Robbie. Robbie, take that flower off and come here. So immediately I'm like, oh my God, well, what did I do? And I immediately know or had the sense that I'm in trouble. Well, she decided in that moment that she would call all the other boys over. And she decided that she would give us a lesson in self-defense. That boys needed to know how to take care of themselves. So, of course, I was the first boy that she partnered up with another boy to fight in a circle. It was like
a baby fight club.
It was like Southern Baptist Jesus Fight Club.
This is messed up. Okay,
it was messed up. And of course,
write this down, Gwaltney. Write.
And I remember the whole idea thing, I remember terrifying me because I had never been in a fight, never wanted to fight. That just was never been my way. And I remember, you know, really being just completely slung around by this fella. And I remember my shirt being ripped, and I remember having to go home and having to attempt to explain to my mom what happened. But that was probably the first most unsettling experience within which I knew that the way that I was and the way that I presented was problematic for some individuals. So that really painted that was the very earliest within which I had an adult. At that point, there wasn't name calling by other children. That really didn't occur until probably elementary school, right, when the name calling started. And fortunately, I think my saving grace, you know, my mom and dad being active in the community, I lived, you know, a comfortable middle class existence. I was a smart kid. I was a well behaved kid. So those who knew me the longest were in some sense protectors. But there right. there was an element of danger with others who, you know, I will call the tormentors, who really terrified me, bullied me all through school, all through high school. Does that give you a sense of what it was like to be gay?
Oh my gosh!
What I admire about you is your strength, and the reason I say that is that when I first read the preface to Cicada Tree, and I was introduced to Annalise Newell, I had no idea the background. Obviously, like me, just learning it now about you, but the character had a personal feel to her, and that was the one that you identified with. And she's a powerhouse. She's feisty. Do you find that she has some of the more rebellious traits that you didn't have as a child?
So that's a good point. Talking about how my background, my growing up being gay in South Georgia impacted my writing. And I do think that the way that it impacted my writing, I think that when you are marginalized in some way, or that you feel that you are, that as a child, you know, you fantasize about having some extraordinary abilities. You know, and I think that that's why some children are fascinated with superheroes, you know, being fascinated with the extraordinary. And for me, you know, magic and fantasy as a child was very important to me. I spent a lot of time in my head daydreaming. So when I wrote Annalise, well, I think that the reason why, you know, I write from a Southern Gothic perspective is the supernatural elements. Magical realism appeals to me. I'm able to do things that I might not have been able to do otherwise. And I'm able to, I think that, you know, as a writer, I live in two worlds. I live in the world that I don't have a great deal of agency in. And then that world as a writer within which I have complete and utter control. So yep. So for Annalise, you know, she is conflicted. There are things about herself that she doesn't understand. Some of them are nature, and some of them are driven by the supernatural. But I do think that conflict in me being gay does show up in many elements of the story that I'm telling in the Cicada Tree.
Well, explain that. Like, what elements come to mind when you talk about how they crop up in the story?
Sure. So there is. One of the things that I've sussed out recently, so there's this family that they're this wealthy, enigmatic family known as the Mayfields. They're very mysterious, and they're this beautiful family. There's this supernatural, otherworldly quality to their beauty, but it's also sort of, and some individuals call it the Mayfield shine. So yeah. I believe that the Mayfield shine. I think that the gay individuals, because of their point of view and because of their circumstance, and because many gay individuals are creatively minded, I don't know why, I can't explain that. I don't know if it's chromosomal. I'm not sure why we gravitate to that. But there are individuals who, in my experience as a boy, certain, you know, young boys who were sweet and kind-hearted, who grew up to be heterosexual, who were drawn to me because of my sensitivity and because of who I was. But they were also later put off by it as well. So the Mayfield Shine, you know, I think that if I dig down into my psyche, it's sort of that phenomenon of being drawn to something that others might feel is dangerous.
That is fascinating. I mean, it's
yeah.
This is the same. It glows in the pages you write, and I feel like I come back and I keep appraising this book. But the Cicada Tree is dialogue. It's, of course, for me, the location. Anyone who has had any family or friends that are Southern will hear that in the dialogue, which is extremely admirable. And the fact that I have read work by those who attempt to use an accent, not even of another gender, of their own, and it come off stilted because they don't talk that way. There's nothing disingenuous about the way you write. And, you know, is it because of, in part at least, because you are so strong and self-aware of who you are now?
Absolutely. And just a quick step back, and I'll try not to take us off track. When I was in college, I graduated from Florida State University, but along the way, at some point, I thought that I wanted to be a communications major. Mm-hmm. And when I was on that early trajectory, I took some creative writing classes, mm-hmm. and I loved them, and I was very excited about them. But I did not come out as gay until after I graduated, until about a year after college. Mm-hmm. And in my attempt to write short stories, and anything that I was writing in those classes came off a bit stilted, because what I wanted to say and what I felt I needed to say was never authentic, because I wasn't being authentic. And I didn't feel, because of, you know, a fear of being out, that I could, no matter how well I could write, because I couldn't find the truth, you know, I would never be successful in it. So I do think that if the Cicada Tree comes off in positive ways, in which people can relate to it, and it does seem truthful to the time and to the people and to the place, I think that it's because of where I am in life, and because of experience, and because I do my best to write from a place of truth.
And I'm going to throw in right now, just in case of people listening think they're going to have this book, I've already put fives on it. The Southern Collective Experience is going to publish this book. I'm just putting that 4-1 in right now. So I put my flag, doof, mine. So Waltney, today, and again, who you've grown into, the experience, big believer, and then that if you don't know it, you can't write about it. The man you are today, who is freaked to a large extent, do you feel that the gay community is being, their freedom is being heard more, the quality of the literary life as it were is getting better?
Well, I think life in general, you know, outside of the creative world, is certainly much different than when I was coming along, even up through the 80s. And I think that life and rights in the world for gay people really probably started to change through popular culture and exposure. And I think that many people would agree that Ellen DeGeneres coming out on her Ellen show was something that helped precipitate that. Though, you know, she suffered after she did so. And it wasn't until a few years later where Will and Grace aired somewhat seamlessly into American popular culture. So it's amazing how it happened. Now, and at some point, I recall, it seemed to me that people felt it chic to have gay friends. And then there's that whole metrosexual phenomenon within which, you know, straight men could look gay and be fabulous, you know. So it was slow coming. I am grateful for it. You know, there are, you know, lots of people before me back in the 60s at Stonewall that began the movement for gay rights and gay pride, and I'm grateful for them. I do think that there are a lot of gay youth today that struggle, that the world's not changed enough to ensure that everyone has a positive experience. I think that the rates of gay youth homelessness is significant. The rate of depression and anxiety and suicide is still significant. So we've come a long way. You know, I never thought that I'd live in a world where we would have the right to marry. And that was life-changing, I think, for many people. And I fear, I hope that in this current political climate that we don't regress in any way. I hope we can only continue to move forward. So I do think that given, well, so I was reading today on your topic about are gay people freer, are we more accepted in the world of literature? And I don't know if I'm pronouncing his last name correctly, but you've heard of Ocean Vuong, who's a poet.
Yes.
And he also has a novel out called, I think, On This Earth, We Are All Briefly Beautiful. I hope I didn't butcher that title. But he writes he writes it as a gay character, and there are, you know, explicit gay sex scenes in this novel, and it is mainstream and people are in love with it. So I do think that the world has shifted enough where gay writers who do write about gay subject matter can be truthful in their storytelling. And I do think that there's an element in our culture today that are accepting of that. And so I think it's awesome.
And go ahead, man.
Oh, okay. So I was, you know, as I'm listening to this, and I'm really affected by hearing you kind of tell the story about growing up. And one of the things that really comes to mind is being a creative person, whether it's being a writer or a musician or any of those things, one of the best things I find that we can bring to that is our, as you say, sensitivity or vulnerability. Growing up in such circumstances, I would imagine there was a lot of times where if you were like me at all, you would sit there and start thinking, well, am I really this horrible thing? Am I really this bad? And then having to come back. But every time I've had to do that, and for other reasons, I've kind of had this little layer of callus grow, and I've had to go through the process of removing those to be more vulnerable. Could maybe, you know, if you want to speak to how did you go through that kind of process, and how do you, even with the things you deal with, I'm sure even now, how do you maintain that sensitivity and that vulnerability to be able to be open to the writing?
Right. So one of the ways that I got through, well, I think that there's some individuals who are born, and I think environmentally it helps as well. You're having a positive environment, a good home life, which helps build resilience. No matter, and I think, but that, so I was able, I always had hope. I always believed that tomorrow could be better. So to give you an example, you know, so when I got into high school, I can remember the most dreaded time and the most dangerous time for me was in between classes when we had to go down the hallways. So I would have to think about, and there were times where, you know, it'd be pushed, knocked into lockers, your books flying everywhere, name calling. And again, you know, this was from a more unsavory element in the community. For those individuals that, you know, I happened to be, and I don't know if they do it in school today, but, you know, there were like three sort of levels of classes. You know, for those who were achieving well, and I was always fortunate to be in those classes, and you had your second tier classes and then your third tier classes. So the kids that I actually had to spend the lion's share of my day with in school were awesome, you know, and for the most part always kind to me. But it was, you know, older kids, it were those kids that were in other classes, you know, where the danger lurked. So right. I think that what it did to me is I did develop, for what I had going for me, is that, you know, I was smart and I was articulate and I was quick-witted. I think that when people are calling you names, you know, you do, for me, it really, I stepped up my game. You know, I mean, academically, I was always on point. So my thoughts were, if you might be able to say this thing about me, but you won't be able to say anything else about me. You won't be able to say that I'm not a good student. You won't say that I'm not stylish and well put together. And I think that there was this perception that I was this goody two shoes, and because of this wall I built, perhaps that I was aloof and that there was a bit of snobbishness there. But those were a persona that I had to build to just to be able to get from classroom to classroom. I tried not to talk back or to address it if there happened to be name calling. I would just ignore it. I would just keep moving. I think that's been my mantra in life, just keep moving, which was the safest thing to do. But what's fascinating is that, you know, I was very involved in school. So often I would never put myself in situations where I would go, I would have to be cautious about where I went in the mornings. I would hang out. I was in the band and I was drum major. So I put myself in like these leadership positions, which made me high profile. But all the while, more than anything, I felt that I needed to do from a safety perspective was hide. So I was conflicted, you know, well, what do I do? But I put myself out there. You know, I continued to achieve, do the things that I felt that I needed to do. But in order to survive, you know, I did build this persona, which took me some time to slowly remove. And that didn't happen until after I graduated from high school, when I was probably after I graduated college and I began to come out. Mm-hmm. When I began to become an authentic and live an authentic life is when I was able to start to drop the walls and the cloak and the veil. But it does impact you. I think that, you know, there were many times during middle school and high school where I could feel myself shutting down. And I think that if I'd been taken to a psychologist, I probably would today have been diagnosed with severe anxiety or depression at times. Mm-hmm. But I was always able to pull myself out of that through, you know, just looking ahead, looking into the future, trying to figure out what my life, or imagining what my life could be. And I think I've gotten off track again.
You were right on point, man. No. It's talking about moving forward, looking to the future. What are your writing goals? What's next for you?
So I am in the process of polishing up my manuscript. You have those writers who say, oh, I just want to write for the love of writing. But for me, I want to write for the love of writing, but I want people to read it.
Yeah.
And I want people to hear the stories I have to tell. So publication for me is so important. I don't have to be, I don't long to be famous. I long to be a writer who writes well enough with a loyal enough following so I can continue to write. And if other things happen beyond that, that would be icing on the cake. Obviously, being able to write full time would be a lovely thing. But I would love to get this novel published. I would love to begin to work, to go back to another project I started working on. I'd love to have that written within a year to 2 years. I mean, I just want to continue writing.
Now, for folks that want to read a little bit of the Cicada Tree now, there's a little piece out currently and some coming out in the future. Tell us where folks can find it.
Sure. So, you know, when you write novels, there's not immediate gratification as it might be sometimes for, you know, if you're a poet or short story writer. And up until April of this past year, I'd been doing nothing but novel writing. And so I decided that, by April, I absolutely have to have something published. So I said, well, I've got the Cicada Tree. I think there are elements of that could be standalone fiction. So I submitted the first chapter of revised standalone piece of the first chapter of Cicada Tree to a publication through like the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga. It's called Signal Mountain Review. So there is a piece. Yeah, you can Google Signal Mountain Review, and the piece, the excerpt is entitled The Deep Down, and it's the first chapter of the Cicada Tree. I have a piece that's coming out in October in the Blue Mountain Review, which I'm really excited about. It is The working title is Garden Crow. I don't know if it's going to be called Excerpt from Cicada Tree. I'm not sure. But it is, I think it's like chapter 6 in the novel, and I'm really proud of it. It turned out to be a nice standalone piece. And then in December, the prologue to the novel is going to be published in the Dead Mule School of Southern Literature.
Awesome, man. And with us running short, I wanted to make sure that we get this in here. Tell us something about tell us as much as you want to, rather, about the Easter Seals.
So by day, I have two passions, obviously, working and helping support the community within which I live, and then writing. And of course, my day job, I work with Easter Seals North Georgia Children's Services. And my role is vice president. We are an affiliate of the National Easter Seals Organization. We just celebrated our 100th year. We've been providing services in the state of Georgia for over 65 years. Quite simply, you know, we are providing services to children and families at the most significant and important developmental time in a child's life. And we do that through two ways, through providing high-quality early education and care services, and through early intervention services for children.
And how can people get online and help this cause, man?
So you just go in and you Google Easter Seals North Georgia. We certainly love community partners. We love individuals to come out to volunteer. We have a walk that's coming up on October 19th. Is called the 9th Annual Trick or Treat Trot. It's going to be taking place in Gwinnett at Thrasher Park. So you can find us on our website there, find out more information. There's a small registration fee for the 5K run, but for children and families, you can come out and participate in the events for free.
Fantastic. I love this show. Amadeh, do you have anything to follow up with?
I've really been enjoying just listening and hearing about the process. I think one thing that I'm kind of tying together is the reason I asked the question a little bit back about retaining your vulnerability is, yeah, even though it's not the same, there is somewhat of a similar journey when it comes to becoming a writer or a creative person and sending things out and getting this kind of rejection back.
Oh, my gosh, absolutely.
And I think it is so hard to retain that, but I think the best people do. And I commend you on being able to kind of come through your childhood that way and I think maybe one thing I would like to ask is a kind of a two-part question, should you choose to do it that way. One, do you have something you would like to kind of – a piece of advice you'd like to give any potential authors or writers who are listening? And two, do you have anything that you would want to impart to maybe anybody who's listening who is growing up in a similar situation, or someone who has and are kind of questioning, can they step out and be creative and be open to the world this way? You can choose either one of those or none of them at all, but I figured I would throw that out.
So advice for anyone who thinks that they might like to write, try it, do it. Try to connect yourself with organizations in the community. We're fortunate in Atlanta to have a lot going on. We have a significant literary community here. But just do it and try it. You know, it is it's very fulfilling, but it can be a very lonely endeavor to write. But if you love reading and you think you might like to write, just do it and try to find someone to connect with, someone to hold you accountable. If you need to take a class, take a class, but just go for it. Giving advice to individuals who might be struggling, I think that, I would hope that that people remember that there's always going to be a tomorrow, that things, I think that there was a whole campaign about it gets better. And it does. When you're under the agency of family members and other caregivers, those circumstances when you're young and you really don't have control over your existence, it can be very challenging. But just remember that, if you can keep your head low and keep moving, there will be a point within which, it will have all been worth it. And I think that I would not be the person that I am today if I had not had those experiences. I think I'm able to look at life and view people in the world around me through that lens. So though at the time it was extremely challenging, I would not change any of that experience, any of the hurt, any of the pain, for anything in the world, because I think that it served me well in life.
Both Cliff Brooks and I want to say thank you for spending your time with us. We also want to extend a huge thank you to Robert Gwaldney for a great interview. You'll be able to find Robert in this month's October 2019 issue of the Blue Mountain Review, and you'll also be able to find him in the December 2019 edition of the Dead Mule School of Southern Literature. You can find Cliff Brooks at cliffbrooks.com or southerncollectiveexperience.com, and you can find me, Michael Amadei, at michaelamadei.com or worldpoetryopenmic.net. The music for this episode was provided by the fantastic Justin Johnson. You can find him at justinjohnsonlive.com. Until next time, remember to be courageous. Do the hard work. Conquer your obstacles creatively. Learn to trust your heart, for it's easy to lose our path in this business of music and poetry.